to set our motivation for tapping into our own Buddha nature, realizing the qualities of the Buddha. Tayata O Mune Mune Maha. Deceit of knowing, or deceit of believing we know, is really the thing, isn't it? That's the trap. The trap of samsara. Well, we all got trapped because we're all here. We got deceived into thinking that it was really good to have a body, and, you know, here we are in the human form again. At least human form is best. Can work with our minds, so it's got at least that potential with us. And not only that, to have this precious human rebirth, because, you know, having the not only the interest in the Dharma, but having a Sangha community, having teachers, having all the access to the Dharma. Actually, in the 21st century, is pretty good, isn't it? At the time of the Buddha, everyone went to the Buddha, you know. The teacher didn't come to everybody. Everyone went to the Buddha, you know. And so if you were lame, or if you were deaf and so forth, you couldn't get the teachings. Nowadays, there's every technology, isn't there? So things have improved a lot. So this thing, when I was thinking about tonight, I was thinking about how we perceive reality, this so-called, whatever we call reality. And I reflected back on my youth in the 60s. I'm that old. And there was this, you know, one song you may have heard. I don't know if they've ever played it since. It was "I Am the Real Thing." I am the real thing. It's a very popular song. Well, many. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of songs of the 60s because they keep rolling out the Beatles again and again and so forth. And what I was thinking about this song, "I Am the Real Thing," because you really get into it and sing it and feel very real, very concrete, very permanent, very powerful just by singing this song. Just singing a song, just these words, you know, "I'm real," you know. Like, and then to be all like, "Get real." Well, what does that mean? Get real. So the Buddha would say, "Get real," but in a different way to we were saying in the 60s, wouldn't he? You know, Buddha would say, "Get real, you know, see things as they truly are, not with all these elaborations our mind puts on top. You know, we make things up and then we believe the hallucination, the fantasy, and then get into trouble as a result." So I thought that we could get a sense of fantasy and reality, or at least the reality part. I think we've got a very good sense of fantasy. So somehow our mind believes that, you know, things are permanent. We start thinking that we're permanent. We forget that, you know, we're subject to birth, aging, sickness, death. Hopefully aging. Although, as the Buddha said, you're aging from the moment of conception, so... You know, when a new baby comes out, you don't say, "Oh, hello, dying body." You say, "Oh, brand new baby." Brand new. I mean, it's a bit of a turn-off, isn't it? You know, proud parents. "Ooh, hello. You're already dying. You've been dying for 9 months." So like that. So it's a matter of perspective, isn't it? So when we talk about knowledge, I mean, actually when I was working here at the university, I was teaching in the Nirugiri, the indigenous unit, and it was very interesting because indigenous ways of knowing, indigenous knowledges. So there's many different ways of knowing, of constructing reality. And all these constructs come from where? From our mind. We create these constructs. We can create these ways of knowing and then believe them. You know, I'm often fascinated by science. Any scientists here? Oh, we've got physicists. Very interesting physics, particularly physics of cosmology. It's a good area to look at. Go for it. But, you know, we have this thing that scientists know the facts, isn't it? Scientists know the facts, true? The facts, there are facts. But even science is a construct, isn't it? I mean, the facts are constructs. If we look at constructs like time, it's a relative thing. When I go to Melanesia, they say, oh, we're on Melanesian time. Or we say they're on Melanesian time. They don't. They just say, this is, you know, it's a little bit slower. And, you know, Sydney time versus last week I was in Wagga. Wagga time's a bit slower too, but not like Melanesian time. That's the slowest I've encountered. Solomon Islands and Vanuatu and so forth. So if you want to go and relax, they're good places to relax. Actually, a lot of Australians do go there to relax. Anyway, so it's all a relative thing, but we make it like it's fixed and permanent. So with time, now I know I was late this evening. Well, I wasn't really, because somebody else led the meditation, thank you. So I was on time, but it's like, you know, works, doesn't it, right? So we can just be flexible in our minds. But what happens, and this is what gets us into trouble, is that we make our thoughts real, concrete, permanent, believe in them. And, by the way, my opinion's the only one and the right one, so you're wrong and I'm right. And so we have a world war. Eventually, you know, we might just have a sort of sibling rivalry or whatever, and then, you know, fight each other in the playground, and, you know, as kids do. But eventually we learn this way of being fixed in this version of reality. So right now we have a human rebirth, and we know, you know, from the Buddha's teachings that you could be born in any realm of existence, in an animal realm, at least you've still got a body there, you know, or you could be born in a formless realm, you could be born in the God realms. No body, still a mind, you know, or light body, you know, no physical form. So not attached to a physical form. Or you could be born in hell realms or, you know, hungry ghosts. So different experiences, which are either different, they're not different places. They're not like, you know, when I was growing up, Catholic heaven was up there and hell was down there. I'm not even sure if Catholics believe that hell and heaven are places, but it sort of sounded like it. Actually, my mother got turned off. My mother, you know, is nominally Catholic, although she says, you know, when I die, I don't want a priest there, thanks. Because they brought me back last time, I don't want them to do that. So, anyway, I want to really die this time. Anyway, she said, anyways, one of her friends has this view of heaven that there's a walled part of heaven and all the Catholics are in there. She said, oh, I don't like that. I don't want to go there. You know, this. Anyway, even fixed ideas of heaven, let alone what's on earth. So this is all open to our beliefs and open to, the Buddha would say, investigate. Investigate what is really there rather than what your mind just puts on top, isn't it? So this idea of permanence, as I said, you know, we forget that we're going to die. Any moment, you know, this breath could be your last. And then working in a Dharma centre, I'm reminded about the impermanence and uncertainty of death, because we don't really know when. We're all going along, you know, a lot of you finishing your studies and planning your lives and your career and so forth. And that could be, not that you want it to be, but it could end any moment, couldn't it? So we get attached to it and we get driven by it. And the thing is to pursue it, but not to get too attached, because it's open to, I remember, it's open to change, subject to change, isn't it? I remember one time I made a 5-year plan. Well, I think in less than a year I abandoned the 5-year plan because none of it had yet come to fruition. So my 5-year, they said, you know, this is what one should do. Make a 5-year plan. So I did. Anyway, so I've given up 5-year plans. I've given up even 1-year plans. I mean, you make plans, don't you? But your plans aren't always going to come out as you want them to. So that's just the stuff of life. So get used to it and don't get upset by it. Why get upset? Because we get upset because we set these expectations. This is what will happen. Just as I want. And what if anything gets in the way, then we get frustrated, we get angry, we, you know, all of these things. We react to it like big drama. We make a big drama. Our minds make the big drama. The big drama wasn't there. Our minds make it up. So, for example, the prison project that I work for, we have an office in the US, and the person who looked after our office until early last year, so for 4 years till then, I got a text on Tuesday saying he had been in a motorbike accident, in an accident on the road, and had very serious brain damage and was on life support, and if he didn't respond within 18 hours, they'd turn off the life support. Well, he died a few hours later. So just like that, 38 years old, 5:30 a.m., not much traffic on the road, and somebody rear-ended him, and he went over. He had a helmet. He had the protection. It's not a guarantee, is it? So there's really nothing that's a guarantee. So, you know, now we're all, you know, saying our prayers and so forth, but it's just like, wow, that, you know, and we hear it in the news all the time, don't we? You know, that life can end just like that. So there's a lot that we forget. In a sense, it's like we're living in a trance, living in the fantasy. And what boggles my mind is what media, anyone studying media? Advertising, anyone studying advertising anyway. So what advertising does, I think it's very difficult to work in advertising and lead an ethical life. I think it is, because you're exaggerating, more than exaggerating the truth. I mean, half these ads, you don't even know what they're advertising, do you? It could be, it's like, yeah, oh, you're advertising sex, or you're advertising, you know, wide open spaces. No, we're advertising a car, we're advertising chocolate bar. Oh, okay. I mean, you see these ads and they just go for it, don't they? That is pure fantasy land. Because you get disappointed then, you get the chocolate bar or the car and they don't do that for you. And the case of the car, you know, while I was waiting to get picked up, you know, I've been at this retreat centre and one of the guys, he had the emergency services come and kickstart his car. So, you know, dream car. All of a sudden, no more dream. Dreams crashed. So, like that. It's the stuff of life. So let's get real about life. What really, really is. So, yeah. Anyway. Because I think ethical ads probably wouldn't sell much. Because I tell the truth. People don't really want to know the truth, do they? They want to know the fantasy. So, yeah. Good evening. Even before you walk in the door, I say hello. So this is the stuff of living in this desire. What is the desire realm? This is a desire realm. Even if you don't want anything, the Buddha said, desire realm, you know. Even you don't want anything, all you've got to do is listen to the ads, go to a shopping centre, and suddenly you want everything. We don't need it, do we? There's enough food in the world to feed everybody. I heard last week or the week before, a third of the food produced in the world gets thrown out. A third. That's a huge amount. A huge amount, isn't it? So it's like the food's there, but there's a distribution problem, isn't there? I mean, there are wonderful people like Oz Harvest and stuff, you know, getting the food and redistributing it, you know, and so forth. But, you know, it's a huge amount. We overindulge the self, the body. And we confuse the self with the body, don't we? You know, I am my body. And if you criticize my body, you're criticizing me. And if somebody says, oh, you know, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're too tall, you're too short, whatever, you're too, don't criticize me. Who's this me who's criticized? Are you your body? The Buddha would say, are you your mind? Is a little bit more accurate. Even then there's debate, but a little bit more accurate, because it's with our mind that we create our sense of me. You know, when that baby pops out, by the way, you know, if anyone invites me to a baby blessing, I won't say, hello, dying baby. I promise. Okay. Oh, you're dying. Anyway, the baby pops out, usually not yet labelled, I mean, currently labelled baby. At what point does baby become Jeff? So is the baby that came out Jeff? No. Jeff came later. Later, you know, you might have even thought of the name beforehand, but once the baby comes out, you don't go, hi Jeff, do you? I don't know, I'm not a parent, so I wouldn't have a clue actually, but you know. But I was there at just after a friend's, you know, gave birth, and the baby hadn't been named yet. Oscar. That was Oscar. Hadn't yet been named. So we label everything just like that. So the mind, so what we directly perceive, straight away on top we label it something, you know, table. If this was inherently table, we wouldn't have to label it, because it is, but we do. So first second we see a form, you know, a shape, we see colour, we see shape, even the colour isn't labelled. We make up all these colours. You know, you go to the paint shop and it's cerise and framboesia and all sorts of fancy colours, isn't it? You know. Anyway. So we make up those labels of colours. When I was growing up, it was so simple. There was just Roy Gabuth, wasn't it? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And even though it was fancy, indigo and violet, you know. It's a bit fancy. We just said purple. Anyway. So then we imbue with that something, you know, like purple's a healing colour and yellow's the sun. And we put other things on top, don't we? And we make stories. Our mind makes stories all the time about everything. All the time. And this is what the Buddha said, just cut through the stories. Get to what's real. And then we get caught up, don't we, in things in the world. And that's the Buddha said, don't just get caught up with everyday stuff, things, you know. So my mother, you know, 93, she's just going into residential care. And last week, you know, she's trying to go through her accumulated, she did a lot of research and so forth, and so she's, you know, ridding herself of the papers from all her research. Word of warning, do it now. And, you know, when I was, when I finished university, first time, undergraduate degree, my parents had this property that, you know, I put all my old exams and essays in the driveway as mulch for the driveway. So, anyway, whatever. They went into the land. I hope they disintegrated. That was a long time ago. So, anyway, so she's trying to get rid of stuff. I mean, they already downsized from a house to the unit, and now she's downsizing to a room. And so getting rid of stuff. And there's no way in the world she'll get rid of even what she's got in her unit. But the process of doing that is good for her mind. So I sort of encourage her. That's good for you. I don't say it's good for your mind. I just say, great, you know, you've done. Because it's letting go, letting go. Letting go of the things that attach us to this life, whatever that is. Family, friends, you know, fashion, whatever. That, you know, our status and so forth. And this is what the Buddha talked about, you know, we get so caught up in the worldly concerns, the worldly dharma, worldly phenomena, you know. And then the main things the Buddha talked about, we want to acquire things, we want property and wealth and prestige. Even if we don't want it, the rest of the world is telling us we should want it, and there's something wrong with us if we don't, isn't it? It's all there, all that advertising, all everything, you know. Buy the real estate, buy the car, buy the yacht, buy the whatever, you know, wear the right labels of fashion and so forth. Do they still do that? Probably do. You've got to wear the right label. I know when I was a teenager you had to wear the right label. And they're all made in the same factory in Thailand. And they just put different labels on it. It was all the same thing. I probably still do that. So it's really meaningless. That's what it was. Really, you know, we haven't got it right. So we want to have things, and we don't want to be without. You know, I was just saying outside last weekend, I was in Wagga, and one of the women there was, you know, sort of saying, I'm practicing renunciation, so I'm going around the house saying, am I happy to live without this, if, you know, if it's taken away from me, this vase or this whatever. Now, not once did she mention iPhone, iPad, computer. Can you live without those? Think about it. You go on retreat and it's sort of technology withdrawal. Help! I can't live without it. So we don't want to lose things. And yet, you do see some people, I'm quite amazed, you know, like with the bushfires and the floods earlier this year. And some people, like, they literally have lost all their possessions, and they're okay with that. I think that's marvellous. It's amazing, because that's non-attachment. So practicing non-attachment, rather than grasping at having things. So, you know, but, yeah, so we don't like to lose things, and yet loss is the nature of life, you know. The Buddha said every meeting has a parting, right? So whether it's life and death, whether it's relationship starting, ending, university ending, you know, suddenly a new part of life opening up for some people and so forth. Everything subject to change. And most importantly, and the way we can transform is our minds subject to change, isn't it? Constantly. Because if our mind, think about it, if it was true that those thoughts, this mind was permanent and fixed, universities would be redundant. Schools would be redundant. You couldn't learn anything because everything would be fixed. It's like you come programmed like a robot. Apparently these nanobots are going to be programmed like humans. Anyway, it'd be interesting to see the future. 2030, they said. It's going to happen. Let's see what happens. So we like it when people, you know, make us feel good. People praise us. People fluff us up, isn't it? You know, say, oh, great. Job well done. You know, I was talking today to this coordinator of the group in Wagga, and I say, you have to praise people. They like that. And he said, oh, in my culture, we don't really do that. And I said, it doesn't matter. People want to be praised. Just tell them they're doing a great job. And keep telling them that. It's not a lie. They are doing a great job, but just let them know, you know. So we want that. We don't like it when people criticise us, do we? So, you know, everyone in the room but one could be, oh, thank you, praise, whatever, and one person says one little thing. The whole world falls apart, doesn't it? Oh, I'm terrible, I'm no good, oh, you know, I'll never pass, whatever. I can't do it. Just one person said one little thing. I mean, just mathematically, it's incorrect. I mean, even if you believe that one person, everybody else is saying you know, why choose to follow this one? Why not choose to follow what everyone else is saying? I mean, we want to be happy, don't we? Buddha said, we all want to be happy, even insects, ants and everything. We all want to be happy. So why go towards the one that, you know, and react, cause of our suffering? We did it, our mind. Dwell on the suffering, and yet we want happiness. Go figure. Why do we do this to ourselves? Why do we give ourselves such a hard time? That's rhetorical. You can think about it, but it's not rhetorical. It's a thing to think about. So we want to have a good reputation. We want to be recognised for our skills, our profession, our whatever, and, you know, yes, decent, reliable person, so forth. We don't like it when we have a bad reputation, when people badmouth us, anything like that, do we? We don't like that either. Because it's like, you mean me? I'm perfect as I am. You know? How could you possibly say anything bad about me? You know? So we build up, we reify, we concretize this sense of ourselves. We make ourselves the center of the universe. This happened, you know, again, going back to the 60s. The me generation, big time. Now I think we have even more big me generation, but it sort of was there in the 60s, you know. I was part of the me generation. Everyone for yourself, basically. A little bit selfish, isn't it? There's 7 billion or 699, whatever, other billion people in the world. I'm just one little insignificant person, and yet we see how the world impacts us, not how we impact the world. And this, the Buddha said, we have to change that. We have to turn that around, transform our minds, because we can. We worked hard to get this precious human rebirth. We you know, practice ethics, discipline, dharma, everything else in previous lives to get what we've got today. And so we've got to turn that mind around and look at the, you know, at least, you know, cultivate the positive aspects of mind, regardless even of what we've done in life previously. Yeah, we've all done good, bad, indifferent. Of course, we've all done that all. But the more we turn towards the good, the more the, you know, the all the disturbing aspects of mind start to subdue, start to weaken. We start to weaken their control over us. So we think one version of reality, but the fact is, even though we're born human now, we know that previously we may probably, you know, we've been in every realm of existence. We've been human, we've been animal, we've been in hell realms, we've been heavens, you know, we've been everywhere. We've done everything, everything. We've killed, we've stolen, we've raped, we've pillaged, we've done all of those things. We've loved, we've cared for, we've been compassionate, wise, all these things. You know, I was listening to one of my teachers last week, and he was saying, we have all, you know, he didn't say achieve Buddhahood, because then we wouldn't be in samsara, but we have all got to the peak of existence. We have all cultivated these amazing qualities of the mind, really gone a very long way, but then we freak out because guess what? The me gets in the way. I'm going to lose the me. I'm going to lose me. Got to have a body, got to have a personality, got to have a sense of me. And so we sort of opt back into samsara. He didn't quite say it like that, but it's my interpretation. But that's what he meant. So we do this. But, you know, that way we'll only keep going around in the spin cycle of life to life, won't we? Really, like that. So, I mean, just, you know, some examples of transformation, because I think they're inspiring. When was that? Tuesday. I visited a prison in Victoria, specifically to give refuge to one person in prison. So he wanted to formally, he'd been studying Buddhism for a while and he wanted to formally take refuge. And we went through, like, I've been in a few prisons. You know, it's my little joke. I'm going to prison today with a smile because I know I'm going to get out as well. So anyway, so there I go. We went through more security gates than usual, because this guy was in a higher level of security. We never ask anyone what they've done. And so then I'm explaining, you know, he's got a monk who visits him regularly, and he's studying and he's practicing. He's doing really well. And he's just so amazed how different he is. And in fact, a friend, a mentor of his who's known him since he was very young, flew across from Perth to be there for the refuge ceremony. And he was just saying how much he's seen the change from this. Well, let's say he wasn't embracing Dharma earlier in his life, let's just say. So he was pretty wild and rough and out there and very negative and very destructive. So this guy killed somebody. Like, we don't ask them, but when we got to the killing thing, then the mentor afterwards said, well, I think he struggled a bit with that one. But he had come to terms with it because he wasn't taking refuge before he killed somebody, obviously. He was taking refuge after he had killed somebody because he knows where his mind can go, has been. Now, probably none of us have ever, I can't imagine having that mindset. I can't even imagine having that mindset. I'm sure you can't either. But to have that mindset, and it can be just a nanosecond if you've got a gun or a knife or whatever, it doesn't take long. So your mind can just be so disturbed in that moment that, you know, you do something very violent and stupid, and the rest of your life, then you're paying for that. So this guy's, you know, he's genuine. He's genuinely taking refuge and doing his practice. And, you know, it's really wonderful to see that sort of transformation from, you know, if you'd asked his mentor, you know, 10 years ago, would this be possible? He would have said, no way. He's like, and for some people, anyone who's committed a crime like that is forever the murderer, you know. Sure, no denying, did murder somebody. Fact. But also fact that he's now, you know, done his best to, you know, seek forgiveness and reparation and all of that sort of thing. He's doing time. He's doing the time that society says you need to do. But he's using that time as his retreat. He's using that place as his retreat centre. He says, great, I can do all my practice here. You know, he doesn't care what anyone else thinks in there about him and what he's doing. Okay, he's probably got a bit of street cred amongst the criminals. You know, don't mess with him. But, you know, he doesn't care. He's just going for it. He's taking that time to say, yep, this is what I'm doing. So that's fantastic. I don't know how much longer he's got in prison, but I hope it's long enough for him to really establish a strong foundation for practice, because guess what? Samsara is alluring, seductive, you know. We get, you know, it's too many things drawing you in this and that direction. We're, I believe the Buddha, I prostrate to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, I take refuge, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and then we go shopping. Isn't it? You know, there are distractions. There's lots of distractions out here in the world. There aren't too many in a prison cell. So good on him. So another example, and this was in Tibet. Farmer. He was a farmer, and then he was imprisoned when the Chinese came into Tibet. He was imprisoned, and he lived in southern Tibet near India, and he escaped. But he couldn't go back to his family because he'd escaped, and if he went back to his family, he'd be back in prison, so he wouldn't be able to help them at all. So he went to India, and he was very angry at the Chinese. He went to India and he joined the Indian army because he wanted to kill Chinese because they'd taken his land and his family and so forth. He was in the army for 8 years. He didn't kill a soul. That's the good news. Didn't kill a soul. And he thought, I've got nothing and all I'm just angry. Guess what? I have to change. I have to do things differently. He went to find the best Dharma teacher he could find. And who he found was the senior tutor of the Dalai Lama. That's a pretty good Dharma teacher. Ling Rinpoche, previous incarnation, you know. And this guy's not completely illiterate, but semi-literate. And so Ling Rinpoche just gave him a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time. And he said, look, that's it. You know, I've tried this and that. I've got nothing. I just want to practice Dharma for the rest of my life. And so he gave him, you know, just sort of little bits at a time. And then he'd go off. He was in Dharamsala, where there's a lot of meditation yogis in the caves, a lot of lamas up there in the caves. And all the caves were full, you know. So he just went higher up. He went way, way up, found himself his own cave. And then every so often he'd come back down to Ling Rinpoche and say, okay, I've done that bit, what's next? I think I understand that one. He'd go up again. And he just kept doing. And so able to he hadn't read all these texts and things because he could hardly read. So amazing. He just got this, you know, the same Lama who's advising the Dalai Lama, tutoring him, is tutoring this illiterate farmer who's then developing these amazing qualities. And so he progressed a long way under this tutelage. And people heard about him, you know, internationally. And he was invited to America. And he was invited there, to talk. And anybody who, you know, is like, the Buddha didn't say, you know, I've got all these amazing qualities, come follow me. The Buddha didn't say that. What did the Buddha say? Well, this is what I found through my experience. Check it out for yourself. Don't believe me. Don't come on blind faith. Don't believe just because I said. You have to see from your own direct experience. And so none of these spiritual teachers ever say what realizations they have, what they understand, you know. Oh, yes, I understand emptiness. Oh, yes, I'm this, I'm that. They don't. And as I say, you've probably heard me say, if anyone ever says that, run in the other direction. It means they haven't got those qualities. Anyway, so this guy was going there, and the Dalai Lama advised him to actually talk about his realizations, to tell people, because they said, you know, because here you've got this semi-literate farmer who's, you know, okay, he's been doing his Dharma practice, but the Dalai Lama said, if you go and say, I have no realizations, they're going to believe you. You know, if the Dalai Lama says, oh, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk, I have no realizations, we go, yeah, sure. We know, don't we? We believe, or at least we believe that he has, because he's got such power in the world. But this guy didn't have any power in the world. He was sort of like a nobody. So he went there, and they said, you have to talk about your realizations so that people know what can be achieved. And so he was very, very humble. And, you know, Bob Thurman, I don't know if you know Bob Thurman, he's the dad of Uma Thurman. But he does say, I do have 7 or 8 other children. You know, he says, oh, you're Uma's dad. Yeah, and I've also got other kids. Would you like to meet them too? You know. Anyway, so he invited this yogi around because he'd heard that he had to talk about his realizations, and he's a great Dharma practitioner himself, and so I thought, great, I can hear it, you know. And so he's asking him, he invited him over and said, okay, now tell me all your experiences, all your realizations. And he had to, because the Dalai Lama had said, and so he's sort of mumbling away going, oh yes, you know, I experience immutable bliss in meditation, and when I'm not in meditation in daily life, you know, in other words, he was saying everything he experiences is like pure joy, happiness, the thing we're all wanting, because we can all transform our experience of the world like that. So we all say, you know, may I, you know, sort of, well, we say in our tradition, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings, all beings without exception, right? And we think about ourselves as a sentient being or as a human being, as a so forth. Already the Buddha says that's too narrow. We all have Buddha nature. Why not think about yourself as a Buddha? You can think about yourself from that perspective, as a human being, as a sentient being. Or you can think about yourself as a Buddha. If you think about, it's not say, not being, not going around saying, people follow me, I'm a Buddha, because that actually goes against refuge. But in your heart of thinking, yeah, I have these qualities. Because we do. I have all these positive qualities. So if I start operating from that rather than from my low self-esteem that says, oh, I couldn't possibly ever do that, that would be, you know, sacrilege or whatever. But from one point of view, we're sentient beings. From another point of view, we're Buddhas. It's a matter of shifting our mind. So if we shift our mind to saying, yep, I've got those qualities within me, and operate from that perspective, we're more powerful. We're more compassionate. I mean, think of the qualities of the Buddha. We're more wise, we're more kind, we're more loving. So, you know, we come from that place as if I was Buddha already. Believe me, I am not Buddha already. But, you know, act as if. And so then it's quite powerful what transformation occurs in our mind, how we're able to deal with situations. Because we all admire the Buddha, don't we? Given, I mean, you're here. I'm presuming you respect, admire, revere, and so forth, the Buddha. Reflection of your own Buddha nature. It's just like a mirror. All the positive qualities within us. So why not say, yeah, I'm going to go for that. I am going to operate from those that positive place, not from my place of restriction or narrowing or I can't or so forth. It's just a matter of changing perspective. And that's more true to reality than sticking with this mind that's attached to having a body, attached to living in samsara, and keep going through the same deal over and over and over. At some point you've got to say, I've had enough already. I'm not going to keep doing this. This keeps, like the prisoner, I'm not going to do this anymore. This keeps me in samsara. Like Losang Tenzin, you know, the farmer. I can't keep being angry at the world. I've got to change. And he did. So it's a matter of us, we can do that. And we can only do that because nothing is as it appears. Everything is, as we say, empty of inherent existence. Everything is transmutable, transformable. Nothing is as we think it is. This is why, this is the deceit of knowledge. We think things are one way and they're not. We think they're permanent, unchanging, fixed, independent. We're all interdependent. We all rely on each other. I mean, come on, Unibuds relies on all of you, isn't it? Right. And even the, as I was hearing, even the former Unibuds rely on, you know, so it's one big family. We're all one big global family. We're all interdependent. Without others, we wouldn't have our clothes, we wouldn't have our food, we wouldn't have, you know, everything in this room, etc., etc. We wouldn't have the university without others and so forth. But how we view ourselves is a matter of perspective. So to the university, you're a student or a teacher or whatever your role is at the university. To your family, you're a son, you're a daughter, you know. And then in workplace, you're a professional. So we've got many, many different perspectives. So why not Buddha as well? Why not? And just, this is the way that we will develop these positive qualities in a really big time, is by saying, yep, I have those qualities, they're in my nature. So why not, you know, put them on show? Why not relate to others like that? Because guess what? The world needs it desperately. Look at the state of the world. Look at those poor people in Syria. Tragic, isn't it? And I just heard today, I didn't hear it in the news, but it got conveyed, the Médecins Sans Frontières, doctors killed. Tragic. I don't know. Did anyone hear that?
In Pakistan.
In Pakistan, was it? I don't know.
Or in Afghanistan, I think.
That's right. It was in Afghanistan, going in there to help people.
Yes, it couldn't do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, stuff happens every day in the world. Tragedy, tragedy, tragedy. It needs all the love, all the compassion, everything, all the kindness that we can give. We can do it. We can all do it. So then, also, we get past our petty mind, our everyday mind, and tap into that Buddha nature, that clear, the mind in all its power. So we have this sort of everyday level of mind, the gross level of mind that gets things wrong, that misinterprets things, that misunderstands things. And then we have this innate, pristine awareness. This is the Buddha mind. This is the enlightened mind. This is what we all have. A pure, clear mind. It's the source of all our power. It's not disturbed by all the emotions that yank us around. It's not disturbed by our afflictions, as the Buddha said, our delusions, the delusions that create all these fantasies that aren't real. Sees everything perfectly, completely as it is. This is the stuff of being a Buddha. What was Buddha? Perfectly omniscient, knowing all things exactly as they are, not exaggerating, not telling the fantasy or the story over the top, not the PR firm, the advertising agency, just as it is, knowing things as it is. We all have that. That is our nature. All that other stuff is just like the weeds on top. So we have this. So another Tibetan story is that if you're a bird and you can fly, why stay in the nest all day throwing out the 21,000 dead mice? So what that means is in a day we have about 21,000 or 21,600 breaths. It's about 15 breaths per minute. That's when we're breathing, you know, normally. It's around about 15 breaths a minute. And then if we, on every breath, you know, the thought that arises after every breath, well, probably there's more than that, actually. There's more than that thoughts, because I think I read 50,000, 60,000 and 70,000 thoughts in a day. How they've measured that, I have no idea. But anyway, we think a lot. And it is the job of the mind to think, isn't it? We do think a lot. And so what this Lama was saying is, you don't want to be trying to chuck out, you know, identifying every thought, or, you know, image, memory, plan, whatever, and chuck each one out. We don't need to do that. If we get in touch, and this is through meditation, with that clear, pristine awareness, our mind in its natural state, in all its power, its luminosity, its clarity, the all-knowing, omniscient mind, then we don't need to attack every little thought, every affliction, every disturbing emotion, one by one by one. We can do that. It just takes a lot longer. But if we get in touch with our true nature and meditate from that space and then bring that into the world, so you take your meditation into the world, you bring the world into your meditation, so it's both, then we all can be like Buddha. And we've still got a bit to, you know, practice along the way, understand more, realise more, check it out, as the Buddha said, analyse it, do your analytical meditation. But, you know, you have it there, right within you, right now. So it's not impossible, it's not unachievable, it's not like, oh yeah, it's in eons to come, you know, long way off. Right now, we can all do that. These people, you know, the illiterate farmer, the prisoner, have turned their lives around unimaginably. Unimaginably. We hear every day in the news people who turn their lives around unimaginably, don't we? Why not, in a spiritual sense, much more powerful? Okay, let's not say, you know, in a mundane sense, do what you want, but don't get too attached to it. Don't get attached to the job, to the body, or everything. So these worldly concerns, we don't like to be uncomfortable. We don't like to experience pain, suffering, and so forth. We want everything to be nice, pleasant, don't we? Well, we get so disturbed when something is unpleasant. And yet, again, I hear stories from our lamas about, you know, many of them who would keep someone around as their cook or, you know, some attendant who just annoyed the hell out of everybody else. Everyone else is like, why have you got this waste of space with you? Like, you know, no good qualities as far as anyone else could see. Because the lamas say, oh, they're my precious teacher. Because you have to work harder. You want to be compassionate and loving and kind, and somebody's really rubbing you up the wrong way. It's a lot tougher. It's easy with our friends and everyone who, nice Dharma club, we can be loving and compassionate towards each other. Easy. But try doing it to the one who really annoys you. It takes a lot more effort, doesn't it? But it's through that effort that we progress. We can, you know, go further along the path that we're doing. How long did I say? Okay, so about 15 minutes. So if you think about it, all the Buddhas, so Shakyamuni Buddha, three countless great eons to get to that life that we know of. Well, we know about other lives too, because in the sutras the Buddha says, in this life I was a Chavi youth, in this life I was Prince so-and-so, in this life I was that. So you know he had previous lives because he wrote about it, he talked about it, he taught it. So it took three countless great eons. And when he sat under that Bodhi tree, he recognized all his past lives. That's one hell of a mind. Sounds unimaginable, but the Buddha said we can all do that. Well, three countless great eons. I suspect mine is more than three countless great eons, but anyway. So the Buddha achieved that prior to that life that we know of, that then he taught for 45 years, everything that he had learned through his own experience, everything he knew through his direct experience, and passed that on to us. But the Buddha was a sentient being, just like us, a human being with all the failings, all the delusions, not in that lifetime, but previously, all the afflictions, and worked hard for three countless great eons to get control of the crazy mind. So you can see, it doesn't happen instantly. It's something we have to work on. But we can. The mind can do anything. We can do anything. Absolutely anything. The only thing that stops us is what? Ourselves. Our own mind. So we search, you know, if we want to realize the interdependence of everything, that nothing inherently exists, it's empty of inherent existence, it means everything has causes and conditions and relates to each other, then we have to analyze, meditate on emptiness, isn't it? We have to understand, who is this me? Where is it? Where did it come from? This me that I label so-and-so, Jeff or whoever, the baby. You know, and we investigate. Is it inside me? Is it outside me? If it is inside me, which part of me is it? You know, is it in my kneecap, in my liver, in my centre of my chest? We often believe, you know, scientists, going back to those scientists, because what happened in sciences in the late 1800s, you know, 1895 and on, there were, you know, early scientists of the brain, of the mind, rather, not the brain, the mind, like William James and so forth. Well, he was actually a philosopher, but he wrote about it. He wrote about needing to develop introspection, this quality that we have in meditation that notices when our mind goes AWOL and brings it back, you know. And our mind gets distracted. So we have these qualities of the mind. The mind can observe the mind. Only a human can do that. The mind can observe the mind. Only in the human life. So let's make the most of it. This is why we can control our mind. You know, when people say, and even not as Dharma practitioners, people say, oh, I lost my mind. Or my mind was elsewhere. So we have these sayings just so people get it. Everyone's aware, right? You're all aware. You know you're aware, right? You do, right? Are we all awake right now? Maybe not Buddha type of awake, but awake. Sentient being type of awake. human being type of awake. So we are, we're all aware, but we also know we're aware, don't we? We're aware of being aware. This is a particular quality as a human. Because if we know we're aware, we know what's going on in our mind, we know when our mind's going, you know, out of, you know, my mind, I lost my mind went elsewhere, so forth. We know we can bring it back, we know we can control the mind, we can develop the mind, we can cultivate these positive qualities. We can only do that right now with this life that we have. So we have to. It's the job of being human. Otherwise, we're just being animals. You know, eating, having sex, you know, even building the communities and so forth. And ants are good at that, building their little anthills, communities. Bees and very intricate beehives. So, you know, there's lots that animals can do. Lots that we can do that animals can't do, that animals can do. But let's, you know, let's be human. And on top of that, develop our utmost potential, our Buddha nature. That's our job. And it's our job not just for ourselves, but for responsibility for the world. You know, one person can achieve so much. It's like, me, responsible for the world, oh no. Well, each individual can achieve so, so much. Just look at how one person in history has managed to kill off nations. Hitler, for example. No, he didn't individually do it, but he got people behind him. He made it happen. So one person could do that, very powerful. One person also can be a world leader for peace. If not a world leader, in your own neighbourhood, in your own family, in your own, you know, sphere of influence, in yourself, it's a good place. Because if you do that, then you'll fly through your exams, no problem. Buddha wrote my exam. Okay. So, meditating on emptiness, on the interdependence, dependent origination, that everything has causes and conditions, didn't just come out of nowhere. Everything is impermanent and ever-changing. Whatever comes into existence has to go out of existence. Even the Buddha, you know, Buddha took a human form for our benefit. Not this form, this is an idealized version. That's not how he looked walking around the streets of India and it's now Nepal. It's not how he looked, but it's the idealized version. But he did take a human form. Why? To be able to transmit the teachings to humans. Because we sort of need to have a body there with a mouth that goes blah blah to be able to hear the teachings. You know, we don't get it like directly, you know. Or at least I don't. No. Okay. So this meditating on emptiness of inherent existence, which is recognizing impermanence, recognizing things come into existence and out of existence, recognizing everything is interdependent, is the best one to shatter this deceit of knowing, the deceit of reality, so-called, that we live in a conventional day-to-day life, of getting stuck in samsara, stuck into the mundane existence. This will blow it apart. And it also frees your mind. You become, we want to be happy beyond just, you know, everyday happiness, the chocolate cake or the, you know, good exam result or the brand new partner or brand new job or brand new house or brand new whatever. Answer to our dreams for today. It will pass. That's the bad news. That's the nature of life, of temporal existence. But if we really want this true happiness, if we're looking from a point of view of being a Buddha already, from all the positive qualities and so forth, we know that we will be happier. Because Buddha's pretty cool. Yeah. Got some pretty good qualities going on there. So if we engage with life on the basis of our positive qualities, we feel better. Hopefully it also has a positive influence on others. Well, it does. Number one, we feel better. We feel more capable, more powerful, more able we cultivate these positive qualities deliberately, our love, compassion, generosity, so forth, and we can make a difference in the world and don't care what other people... I mean, that's what happened to this Tibetan, Losang Tenzin, when he was still in the Indian army. He still had a year's more to do after he found his Dharma teacher, Ling Rinpoche. And he was in his barracks doing his prostrations, doing his practices, and it would be like, all the others are, what are you doing? And he's just like, I don't care what you think, get out of my way, I'm prostrating, you know. He was like, I don't care what anyone thinks. And this is the courage that it takes, the courage to go against what the advertising's telling you, the courage to go against what we hear all around us in society. Come by me, I'm gorgeous, I'm delicious, I'm whatever. I mean, how many varieties of ice cream and chocolate and God knows what do we need? We have more foods than I could ever imagine, more than I've ever heard of, isn't it? And that's just the food department, let alone the clothing department and the car department and everything else. Much more than we need. We don't need it. We really don't. We just need to get by. You know, a car's good to function, gets you from A to B. Usually. My car doesn't anymore, it died. But it was old, you know, 96 model, a little bit old. So, you know, they're pretty reliable. But it's a car. It's not a relationship. You know, let it stick at being a car. You know. And who cares what labels on your clothes, as long as they cover up the bits that need to be covered up and keep you warm when you need to be warm, and let you be cool when you need to be cool. Not cool, but cool. So, I can share another story. You want another story? Yeah, so this is also about transformation of the non-human realm. So there was Sarah J Monastery. It's one of the monasteries in Tibet, mostly relocated to southern India. So Sarah J Monastery is one of them, big monastery. And the abbot of that monastery was talking, was mentioning that he looked after a cat that came into the monastery, and he'd feed it and look after it and so forth. We have a cat like this that comes into our Dharma Centre. It's a bit freaky because I think, where did you come from? I mean, I know it came from three doors down, but it walks in like it knows the place, and it just sort of, hello, I'm back. And we had this lama visiting, this young lama visiting, and the cat just came in, sat in the teachings, and when he finished talking, it went out. Thank you, got the teaching. Very interesting. Anyway, it's probably a human projection on my part, elaborating on top of the cat's story. The fact that he just found a very nice cushion to lie on and fell asleep. But this cat, the Sarah J monk had, abbot had, stopped killing mice. It stopped chasing, killing mice, bringing in mice, anything. And just, you know, was content and happy in the monastery. So even the cat, whose tendency is to what? Kill the birds, kill the mice. That's a tendency in the cat realm. Didn't do that. You know, there's another one. I saw it on YouTube of this cat that... I can't remember where it is, but it sits there in the temple in front of the Buddha image all day with its little paws like this, like prostrating to the Buddha, like this. And the only time it gets up is probably to go and do pee-pee and whatever, and when they take it to be fed. And so this cat will only eat vegetarian food. And they've tried to tempt it, you know, put out the vegetarian food, one bowl right next door, the, you know, red meat and then the fish and then the chicken, all next door to each other. And it only just goes, and they're equally spaced, whatever, just goes to the vegetarian. And goes back and then runs back in and sits prostrating to Buddha, you know, all day. That's all it does. Amazing, isn't it? So that cat's, regardless of what's going on in the cat mind, not much goes on in a cat's mind, but is that it's, you know, it's getting very good imprints. It's got a good location, you know, at the feet of the Buddha. Wonderful. Let's hope, you know, next rebirth can do that in human form. So pretty, you know, so anything's possible. So St. Francis of Assisi, you've heard of St. Francis of Assisi. He started the Franciscan Order and was a great meditator himself and practitioner. And anyway, so there was this wolf coming into town and killing the animals and so forth. Well, probably not into town, into the farms. Anyway, the village. And so people went to St. Francis and complained. So he went to have a chat with the wolf. So he went to the wolf, and the wolf sort of almost prostrated as well and licked his feet and so forth. And he fed the wolf and then said, please stop going into town and killing. You know, I will look after you, but please stop doing that, going into town and killing all the animals. You know, I'll feed you. Wolf's happy. He had the capacity to talk to animals. We would say that was a Buddha. So who knows? Don't mind saying from St. Francis was a Buddha. You know, who knows? Could talk to the animals. Truly, this happened. So this is the nature of a Buddha, has the capacity to talk to a being in whatever language is required, you know, not just all the languages of the human world, but, you know, animal realm, so forth. So in whatever way. Anyway, these are stories. You can check them out. Investigate it. Investigate it for yourself, because, you know, they're just stories. But we do know that things are constantly changing, including the fact that who's your friend today could be a total stranger tomorrow, or who was a total stranger yesterday could be your friend today. And then if they criticize me, they become my enemy. They become my enemy. So just one example of the emptiness of this. At the retreat centre, I'm at this sort of Christian retreat centre, because we need a place that can house, you know, 45, 50 of us, and they can. And then I was on the internet looking for one of my teacher's schedules, because I'm planning the schedule for next year for our centre. And it blocked. I couldn't get onto the website. It said, you know, St. Joseph's, that's where we are, has blocked this due to alternate beliefs. Immediately my mind goes, what? Alternate beliefs. And I'm thinking, should I check out who else? They were alternately. I thought I'd better not put in ISIS. I might get arrested, you know. But I was a bit freaked out by then. And then I went down to reception and said, I was trying, and, you know, I resolved the situation. I got to talk to the teacher and we sorted things out. But I still can't get onto that website. And I went down to reception and I said, you know, one of our teachers, and I'm thinking, is it because we're Buddhist? But hold on, they've got us here. So, you know, your mind goes through all these stories. My mind did. And I go to reception and I say, I can't get onto that website. And they said, I know, we've got problems. And the thing is, we can't get onto our travel agent, and we can't get onto the bus timetables to tell people what time to catch the bus. So it's like, oh, I think you should change alternate beliefs, because it's not about alternate beliefs. It's about, you know, the system's not working. We've got a problem. So my mind immediately made a whole story out of those two words, alternate beliefs. So easy, isn't it? And it dissolved. As soon as I got the right information, it also dissolved. So it's like that with our Dharma practice. As soon as you get the right information, the hallucinations dissolve, the delusions, the afflictions dissolve, because now you're coming from a place of true knowledge, of true knowing. Okay, I better stop there for the questions. I said I'd allow time for some questions. Are there some questions? I don't know. Yeah?
The sense
there was a box going around. Anyway, while that is going around, yes.
The sense world is so alluring.
Yes, sense world, yeah.
It's so easy to get attached to it, to keep going back to it.
Yes.
How do we detach from it?
Okay, so it's not about dissociation, like, you know, I'm just going to, you know, sort of... dissociation is a bit like you go into a... You know, you can't go into a... What is a sensory deprivation tank for the rest of your life, can you? You know, might be good to try. for a moment or two, or, you know, see what it's like. But we do engage in a sensory world. But if we look at the fact that that is all empty of inherent existence, it's not a permanent sense. You'd say, okay, this pleasure is going to last for as long as I eat this chocolate or have this whatever, or, you know, whatever it is. It's not permanent. It's not the source of my ultimate happiness. And you can still enjoy it for a while it lasts, but know that it's not the answer to my dreams. Everything is not the answer to my dreams. And, I mean, you can also try little experiments, like, decide I don't have to be 100% comfortable 100% of the time. So let's just see, you know. For example, for myself, well, it's quite warm weather now, but, well, seems to me. It's warm tonight, right? Is it warm? I don't know. You've all got... I was looking today and people had jacket. Maybe I've just sort of got a bit of internal warmth going on. Anyway, it feels to me like it's... See, I think it's external, but it could all be internal. Isn't that funny? That's what the Buddha said. it's all in the mind. but when it's cold, you know, people often say to me, aren't you cold? I do experience the cold, but I think if I can tolerate a bit of cold, you know, I don't have to be attached to being warm all the time. So if I can tolerate that a bit, then that breaks down my... that sort of wanting that sense pleasure, you know. So our eyes are attracted, you know, we see an attractive form. But if the Buddha would say, that form is not inherently attractive, because if it was, it would be attractive for absolutely everybody, and it's not. You know, one person falls in love with another person, and someone else says, oh, they're ugly. Well, I don't know if they'd say, they wouldn't say it to their face. But I've heard the phrase, I don't know what she sees in him. I don't know what he sees in her. Have you heard that sort of phrase? Yeah. So if it was the same, that the attraction force from their side, everyone would experience that as beauty. Just go to an art gallery. I mean, everyone has different preferences. Even people totally disinterested in art. I don't know the way you put a hunk of paint on a wall, I don't know. But, you know, they could. So for some people that's attractive, and that's a pleasant way to spend a Saturday afternoon at the art gallery or whatever, but not for everybody. So you see, this is not inherently beauty. It's just my mind has decided that. So that's what you do. You investigate. While you're on your own, in your meditation session, you investigate. Where does... Okay, so just on this sensory one, I think I'm getting to some very simple practice here. It's a classical practice in the four close applications of mindfulness, mindfulness of feeling, which is not about emotions, it's about experience of pleasant, unpleasant. So you just check in with your body and you notice in your body, oh, that feels a pleasant sensation. We label it, oh, pleasant sensation. And as my mind goes towards pleasant sensation. And then I've been sitting cross-legged for a few days, so my knee's been aching. That's been an unpleasant sensation. And I've been very well aware of that and wanted to change it immediately. And so you can still change it, but you just notice your mind will have an aversion to some experiences, just physically in your body. We're not talking the outside world, in your body. And it'll have preference for some and have aversion for others, and most of the sensations we're not even aware of, you know, or, you know, we're indifferent towards. Oh yeah, the breath's going great, good, means I'm alive, but it's neither here nor there. I neither have a pleasant or unpleasant relationship with my breath. But, and so you realise that, and you realise the mind is doing this all the time with sensations in the body and with the world around us, with everything we engage with. And by noticing, oh, my mind's, and this is the capacity of being aware, oh, look, my mind goes towards that. Oh, my mind doesn't like that sound. There's nothing inherently awful about that sound. even a lot of people agree that's not a nice sound, it could be music. And this is why a Buddha would transform all sound into music, would transform all sights, everything that appearing to the eye, into the most gorgeous thing. Just transform everything, make it beautiful. So we just practice noticing what the mind does with the sensory, because ultimately it's the craving that keeps us stuck, isn't it? The craving at wanting, desiring. It's going to happen because, as I said, this is a desire realm. It's like the function of the world in which we live, is desire. But, you know, we can just be a bit more, have a bit more equanimity, a bit more distance from it and observe it without following after each one.
So it's a lot of discipline.
Yes, it's practice. It's practice. Because guess what? We've practiced not having that discipline. We got very good at that. Just a practice. We may have done lifetimes. So you practice. And you notice. More and more you notice. Yeah, it's okay. Okay. Other questions? Is there someone from that box? Oh, okay. We've got a little bit of time and a lot of questions. Okay. Is this one big long question, this one? Is that two bits? No, it's two questions, right. Do you think that given the difficulty in seeing what is real and what is delusional, should we rely on and embrace and rely on the scientific method? Well, the Buddha would say is rely on and embrace your own inner wisdom. You check it out. Because, I mean, scientific method, there's a lot of sciences. So check out what they say. Is it true? If you're talking about any psychologists here, any training psychologists here? So psychology is about what? The mind, right? Study of the mind. Would you agree?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not a psychologist either. Just as a sort of layperson's view. It's not a test. Okay. You can debate. But generally, my understanding is what psychologists deal with is we've got these emotions that are running wild. We can't get control of them. I need someone to help. I go and seek help, professional help, because I'm anxious, I'm depressed, I'm afraid, my emotions are going to town. All our emotions are going to town. But in the textbooks for psychology, there's no study of what is the mind, how does the mind work, what is the nature of mind, how can we observe the mind. It is not there. It seems like there's something lacking, wouldn't you say? To my mind, there's something lacking. And the reason is from the 1910, after 1910, so from 1895 to 1910, there was this sort of study or attempt to study the mind, and they didn't come up with any conclusive. It was all a bit inconclusive. And then what happened was the material sciences came in, and everything is like, it's all based on matter. There's nothing that exists that's not material. Well, of course we know that there are things that exist that are not material, isn't it? Space exists. Is space matter? No. Belief systems exist. Are they matter? No. Thoughts exist. Are they matter? No. Mind exists. Is it matter? No. So in terms of that, in terms of working on the mind, which is what Buddhism is all about, relying on the scientific method, I would say, is a little bit too short-sighted, just as this current point in time. Things are changing. They're starting to look at the mind and get understanding, but it's very early days and there's not really much understanding. Because there's still this thought that it has to be matter, therefore the mind has to be the brain, and if we just find the right chemical and prod the right bit. I mean, I saw Stephen Hawking's, he had a not real head, I hope. But anyway, he was probing bits of this model and you probe this bit and you'll get a pleasure sensation. You probe this bit and you'll get an anxiety response. And it's just like, doesn't get it, you know. There may be a brain correlation, but it doesn't, all our thoughts don't come from the brain. And that's what the mind does, it thinks. So the mind is not matter. That's why it can change. That's why it's infinite potential, because it's not fixed by any barriers whatsoever. So I would say for a practice of meditation, scientific method not so good. For understanding astronomy and physics and chemistry, these sorts of things, yeah, go for it. For understanding brain chemistry, go for it. But for Dharma practice, I think difficult. That would be my response. We could talk for hours, but we don't have hours. People say live your dream. However, if you do not have a plan and dedicate yourself to follow your plan, how could you be able to achieve your dream? This looks like three questions. If you don't have a plan to practice meditation on a daily basis, how could you form your habit to meditate? Oh, yes, right on track. I think you've answered the question. I think this is answers with a question mark at the end. How would you explain live your dream and how to achieve your dream without a plan? Okay, so I'll take the middle one. Practicing meditation on a daily basis, you do have to plan for that, because otherwise what happens? The lazy mind comes in and goes, I'll do it later. And then later comes and I'm too tired, I'll do it tomorrow. Isn't it? You know, stuff happens. So best to say, okay, I got my work plan for the day. Get up, meditate. Do it first thing in the morning, before too many other things get in the way. Your mind is in its clearest state. You know, you've had a rest. You know, the body's regenerated itself and so forth, and your mind's at its clearest point. You might think it's not 100% clear because we're not there yet, but it's the best time. Get up and meditate. But you've got to plan for that. You've got to say, I have this time. So if you don't have the time, you say, okay, I've got to set the clock, you know, half an hour earlier or an hour earlier, depending on how long you're doing your meditation for, or whatever. You've got to get up and be awake to do it. So like that. And the same, you know, do you know what your dream is? Because if your dream is, I mean, the Buddha would say we're all following dreams all the time and we're not planning for it. We're just, everything's a dream and we're, you know, dreaming. You're dreaming, as they said in The Castle. That's an Australian film. That's obligatory viewing. Well, it's just funny. Okay. So we all have aspirations. If I say aspiration rather than dream, if your aspiration's to be a Buddha, you've got to do your Dharma practice. You've got to learn about what that is and how to do it. And then you put it into practice. If your dream's to be a doctor, you do the study. And then, you know, you get competent at practicing being a doctor, and then one day somebody will let you be a doctor. So anything we do in life, we do plan for, don't we? We do. I mean, it is true. I made my 5-year plan and, you know, out the window. But it's still plan to do things in life. And have achieved a few of those. Let go of a few along the way. So, but everything. You know, when I was young, my mother was a music teacher. So from, you know, when I could put my little hands on the keyboard, she taught me piano. So I got very good. Every morning, practiced piano. Up until, you know, I was doing 4 hours a day, practiced piano when I was older. So I got very good at that. Now I'm a nun, renounced all that, don't play the piano. That's fine too, for that time. You know, that happened. But if I hadn't got up every morning and practiced, I never would have been able to play the piano. Anything we do, we've got to practice. So we make our plan and we say, how do I achieve this? Well, I need a teacher. I need someone to guide me. On a spiritual path, you've got to be very careful. Carefully choose your teacher. Because you want to make sure you've got the teacher who's got the goods, that knows the Dharma. That is at least further along the path than you. Because if they're further along the path, as you progress along the path, they've already progressed further. So they don't have to be, you know, Buddha. As I said, Buddha, 2,500 years ago, sort of. Unless you have a direct you know, communication with Buddha. Some people do. But most of us need a human form. So find someone reliable that you can learn with. Or even more than one. You know, this is my meditation teacher, this is my Dharma teacher. Or this one knows how to do this. Like anything, like at university. You pick different subjects, you have different teachers, different teachings, so forth. You learn. So it's the same. So I would change the word dream to aspirations. Dreams are a bit ephemeral. Because our dreams are like our thoughts, you know. Well, no, they're not like our thoughts. Our thoughts are real. They're just not something you can grab hold of, concrete. They do exist though, don't they? We do think a lot. Okay. I hope that helped. What was the third part? How would you explain live your dream? Yeah. You can't achieve, the last bit, you can't achieve it without a plan. Full stop. One of the five precepts says we should avoid stealing, which comes to my question on whether stealing time is considered breaking the fourth precept, which is no stealing. Yep. So you define what is stealing time. If I define stealing time, so one way, yeah. So say I've got a boss, and my boss says, okay, while you're at work, you know, they give you a certain amount of time to check your personal emails or whatever. But the rest of the time you're working. Or maybe they don't give you that time. But get clear and say, okay, you've got this amount of time. But the rest of the time you're working for me. So you're working for them. So it is true then if you're in that time doing other things, then you've got to be careful because that would be stealing time. That's how I would interpret stealing time. In the Dharma, we're always encouraged not to waste a precious moment, you know, to always be on the case, practice Dharma. But, you know, we're also human beings and we forget. We do our best. So don't stress out about that. You're all doing your best, doing a good job. So you do what you can. And all sorts of other things, as I was saying at the beginning, time is a relative thing, and all sorts of things get in the way. How long did it take you guys to get out to pick me up? An hour and a half. An hour and a half. And how long did it take us to get here? 45 minutes. Same distance. It's a relative thing. You sort of got to plan for that. So if it was cheating on the boss's time and taking the money, thank you very much, when you're not actually doing the work that you're being employed to do, that's a clear case. It's the only really clear case. I mean, there probably are other clear cases. That's the one that comes to mind. And when you say breaking the precept, you know, by the root, is that you are taking what is precious to someone else. So in that case of the boss, yes, it would be, because it's taking productivity, right, away from the boss. I mean, that precept, anyway, is very interesting. We could go on about just that precept, because another translation is don't take what's not given. I mean, that's usually material things. So if it's not given, don't take it. Like, don't pick flowers out of the park and take them home and put them in your thing, because, you know, it's communal. Because they're actually there to provide, you know, a nice environment and beauty for people to enjoy in the park. You know, it used to be that, I think they've stopped this now, but people would take, you know, bits of sand or, you know, up in Queensland, they have all the different coloured sands, and everyone would go and pick their sand and take it home. Now somebody does it as a business and you've got to pay for it. So you don't take what's not given. I mean, there's a whole history of that in museums where they've taken relics and all sorts of the Elgin marbles, isn't it, from Greece. They're still fighting with the British Museum to get them back, I think. You know, you just came in and nicked them. So there's clear examples like that in the world, let alone stealing, you know, being a thief and stealing in that way. That's an obvious break. But I think the stealing time, you just get clear about that. If you could say, I mean, stealing time from yourself is just silly. It's not really stealing, it's silly. You've made your plan, I'm going to study at this time, and then you go and play computer games or whatever. That's just self-sabotage. I'm sure nobody does that. Okay. I hope that helped. If it didn't, you can have a subsequent question. Progress in society is fundamentally based on increasing knowledge and acting for the benefit of the greater community. How can we moderate our actions to still be active and contributing member of this world while following the Buddha's teachings? To my mind, this is not contradictory. It's totally what the Buddha was on about. The Buddha was on about being more available to act for the benefit of the greater community, for all beings. I mean, ultimately, we want a Buddha and know exactly what to say and what to do in what language and in what, you know, to animals, to humans, to everybody. But in the meantime, everything that we do, you know, our purpose in life. So the Buddha said, if you're a doctor, fantastic profession, because what are you doing? Saving lives. So your intent is to benefit others. I mean, a doctor doesn't go around a hospital and say, oh, you don't look very sick, I'll come back tomorrow and see you, and you're on death's door, forget it, you know. Hope you have a peaceful death. A doctor ministers to everybody equally, doesn't, you know, distinguish. Everybody gets the treatment appropriate. So that is contributing to society. We do have to... So, I mean, when you say increasing knowledge, I don't know if this means which knowledge this means. There's many knowledges. So there's a certain knowledge you need for the job. Apart from that, we are in information overload in the world. I mean, everything's there, isn't it? It's on the net, it's in the news, it's everywhere. There's way too much information, more than we need. So we can all, you know, learn everything there is to learn, it seems, but be very careful about the purpose. So as long as your motivation, if your motivation is, I am doing this because I can see how my knowledge of this will be a benefit to others, that's your Dharma motivation. That's putting your Dharma into everyday life. It doesn't have to be sitting there reading Dharma texts and, you know, just studying Dharma. That's very useful, absolutely essential. You know, learn ethics, learn, you know, learn about these things, emptiness, impermanence, cultivate compassion, kindness, so forth. All of that's... But what's the point of any of that if we can't practice it in daily life? We've got to do it all the time in daily life. So you think about, you know, how's my profession going to be of benefit to others? Now, presumably nobody's training here to be a mass murderer or a thief or something like that. You know, obviously not of benefit. And very karmically negative. But, you know, as I said, I don't know about the PR one. I think that would be very difficult to be ethical. I also think it seems that being a politician is very difficult to be ethical, maintain ethics. But, you know, there are still politicians in there ready to, you know, do what they can to change. Okay, they may not be the head of the country, but, you know, they're probably doing their bit and representing their people and so forth to the best of their ability. I don't think it's all bad, you know. We hear all the bad stuff on the news, we get a bit of it out of perspective. So you just think, what's going to help me help others? Maximum benefit in the world, to myself and to them. Yeah, very good question. Oh, have we run out of time? Sort of, yes. That'll be a sort of yes. Okay, I hope this has been of some benefit to you tonight, and encourage you to continue on your Dharma journey, but most importantly, putting it into practice everyday life, being kind to each other. We need it in the world. I'll just dedicate on that. May whatever virtues and positive energy we've generated here together, and there's been a massive amount, I mean, just contemplating the Dharma, the Buddha, you know, Buddha Dharma, is amazing. so wonderful, so rejoice in your own merit. May that continue to grow and grow and be a benefit not only to myself, but all those beings I encounter. Gewadi no duda lama sange ropyune dro vachikyam maharupa dehe sala gopashuk jangchob sencho gwinpo she makye panam ge kuchik ye panyam pa me payam gong ne gong du pyo washuk.